John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. In 2012, Washington State and Colorado became the first states in the U.S. to make recreational use of marijuana legal. Since then, Oregon, Alaska, and the District of Columbia have also changed their laws to make pot legal for recreational purposes. A number of other states have medical marijuana laws on the books, but pot is still an illegal drug as far as federal law is concerned. Colorado and Washington State have become a sort of laboratory to test the effects of legalizing pot. But how did we get to this point? What happened during the first decade of the new millennium to change public opinion to the point where legalized pot is even possible? And what has been the result of making it legal in those states that have tried it? To answer these questions and to answer yours as well, we've invited award-winning author Bruce Barcott to spend an hour with us on the Kathleen Dunn Show to talk about his new book, Weed the People. Barcott writes about science, the environment, and the outdoor world. His work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, Rolling Stone, The Atlantic, Outside Magazine, and other national publications. Bruce Barcott, welcome back to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you, John. It's great to be back here.
So there was no federal regulation of marijuana until 1937. Some states had outlawed its use, but it was legal in most of the U.S. Why did the federal government step in?
Federal government stepped in mainly because of one person. His name was Harry Anslinger. He was sort of the J. Edgar Hoover of drugs back in his time. He was the first commissioner of drug enforcement for the federal government, and he stepped into office around the time of the Great Depression when a lot of budget cutbacks were happening in the federal government. And he needed sort of a reason to justify the existence of his agency, and he looked around and found marijuana as a sort of demon drug that a number of people had raised a fuss about in local jurisdictions, places along the Mexican border and out west, where he had a lot of Hispanic workers coming across and sort of using it on their spare time. So you had Harry Anslinger kind of latching upon marijuana as a drug about which, you know, the people, basically the white Americans, knew very little. So he could drum up a lot of support for outlawing the drug and then ramping up his agency to carry out those laws. Really, when it passed, the federal outlawing of marijuana was a big deal for Harry Anslinger and his agency, but it was a small item in terms of Congress sending it through. I think there were a few people on the floor of the House when it went through in a late summer, you know, burst of lawmaking before they got out of town, and nobody really knew about the drug or cared about the drug at the time.
Well, and the AMA had given testimony to the relevant congressional committee saying, we don't know what problem you're trying to fix here. Marijuana is
right. Fairly
harmless. And then on the floor of the House, someone said, well, what'd the AMA say? And, well, they're with us.
Well, it was funny. The actual answer on that from the House floor was very smart. The answer that one of the congressmen gave was, the AMA is unanimous. And they were unanimous, but they were unanimous against the law. They really saw no reason for it. And really, one of the things that really drove this law from the beginning was a fear of race mixing. It goes back to America's race problem. And for Harry Anslinger, that was one of the hot buttons that he could really push, was that he would go out and essentially give a roadshow to Rotary clubs, to civic groups, whoever would hear him speak, and he would say, look, this drug is causing horrendous crimes to go on, but really, more to the point, it's causing white people and black people to get together and have a good time. One of his most sort of powerful cards to play was he would pull out these notes, you know, from his agents taking note of cases around the country, and he would say, I have one agent's note from the University of Minnesota here. We have colored students at the university partying with female students, smoking and getting their sympathy with stories of racial persecution. And then at the end of the card, it said, result, pregnancy. And that was sort of the big hammer that Anslinger liked to bring down.
Well, and you also had the Hearst papers and their sensational headlines. They were definitely involved in this as well.
Yeah, they were. They were sort of went hand in glove with Anslinger's campaign. You know, his campaign really wouldn't have had as much power behind it if he didn't have the Hearst papers to rely upon for these outrageous headlines and news clippings that he could then show to folks around the country. So they would kind of work hand in hand. One would drive the other. He would take these news clippings back to Washington, D.C. and sort of slip them under the door of his bosses, and his bosses would come charging into his office the next day and say, "Anslinger, what are we doing about this marijuana menace?" And he'd say, "You know, we're on it, boss. You know, we're ramping up our laws." So it did really go hand in hand with the Hearst papers.
So we had this taking place in 1937, sort of the beginning of the regulation of marijuana. It was a tax at first. So let's fast forward a bit, because we could spend all day talking about history, but I want to provide enough of a context so that we can launch into the really relevant part of this whole thing, which is what's happening now in Colorado and Washington State. Fast forward to the 60s, tune in, turn on, drop out. We had all sorts of drug use happening as people were experimenting. They were trying to raise their consciousness or whatever. And marijuana was a part of that, certainly part of that scene. But along comes Richard Nixon.
Right. Richard Nixon comes along, and this is about the time that the Controlled Substances Act makes its way through Congress, late 60s, early 70s. And the Controlled Substances Act sets up this schedule of drugs. This is how we rate drugs, you know, from the least dangerous to the most dangerous, Schedule 1 being the most dangerous. And so everybody could pretty much agree that heroin and LSD and some other drugs would be Schedule 1. But they didn't quite know what to do with marijuana, and there was a lot of arguing to put it on Schedule 1. And in the end, the lawmakers said, Congress said, okay, look, we're going to put it at Schedule 1, but we're going to have a commission look into it. So President Nixon appointed a commission to look into marijuana, and it was essentially stocked with rock-ribbed Republicans. It was a complete, Republican commission going in looking at marijuana. They went in good faith, dove into the subject, came back a year later, and they essentially said, what we're finding here is it's really not that big a deal. It should not be Schedule 1. In fact, we think it should be decriminalized, and we should take a lot of the spotlight and pressure off of marijuana. Well, at the time, Nixon was running for re-election. It was 1972, and there was no way he was going to decriminalize marijuana at the time. As Nixon called them, the long hairs were all against him, and the long hairs were into marijuana. So the idea of decriminalization pretty much died on Richard Nixon's desk, but it was kind of one of many government committees and institutions that looked into marijuana, and they all kind of would come back with the same answer, which is that, this is not a safe drug, but it's not nearly the dangerous drug that it's been made out to be. Well,
the irony for me was that Nixon rejected what basically experts were telling him, who'd actually done some research, but he took Art Linkletter's word for it.
Yeah, Linkletter, Linkletter was a big anti-drug crusader back in the day, and of course his daughter committed suicide, and that was what kind of drove Linkletter to come out so harsh against drugs. But essentially, I found a portion of the Nixon tapes which cover this period, and the Nixon tapes have a conversation between Art Linkletter and Richard Nixon in the Oval Office, and they're talking about marijuana, and Linkletter's saying, this is, the worst thing in the world would be to decriminalize or let marijuana slide in any way, and it's not like alcohol. Nixon says, "Oh, really, I agree with you on marijuana, but why is it not like alcohol?" And Linkletter says, "Well, people drink alcohol to be sociable, but when they do marijuana, they do it to get high, and they go on to do harder drugs and harder drugs all along the line, and pretty soon they're heroin addicts." And so essentially, that was a conversation, normal, but then you'd hear the phrases of Art Linkletter come up from Nixon's mouth later on when he's talking with other aides about marijuana policy. So he really took that to heart.
Mm-hmm. And then there was a moment during the Carter administration when people thought that there was at least an outside chance we might get to decriminalize marijuana. That died, and then we got Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign.
Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign came in about, 81 or I must have been 82, when she was really floundering in the polls. It was the height of people were seeing portraying Nancy Reagan as the next Marie Antoinette. And she needed an issue that she could really go out there and turn her image around on. And she found drugs and latched onto the war on drugs and really helped make it happen with Nancy taking on drugs and especially marijuana as her issue, and then her husband really ramping up laws against drugs and especially marijuana. That was when, I mean, Nixon started the war on drugs in terms of the phrase war on drugs, but Reagan really was the one who ramped it up.
Mm-hmm. So how did we get from that and years of strict enforcement, billions, perhaps trillions of dollars spent to try to eradicate marijuana? How do we get from that to all of a sudden, here we are in 2012, and we have states voting on whether or not to make recreational pot use legal. I mean, in the meantime, we had had a number of states who had passed medical marijuana laws. There was a recognition even at the federal level that there were some actual medicinal properties in marijuana that could be beneficial to people, mm-hmm. for example, who had glaucoma. And so we had that whole trend line going alongside the war on drugs. But how did we get to the point where it was possible for the voters in a state like Colorado or Washington State to say, you know what, let's just make it legal to use pot recreationally, and we'll see what happens. We'll collect all kinds of tax revenue. It'll be a bonanza. How did we get to that point?
A couple things happened, I think. In essence, you can lay it at the feet of the internet and medical marijuana. The internet came along, and all of a sudden we had access. Every person had access immediately to a lot of information about marijuana that hadn't been available before. Whether that's sort of counter narratives coming up from the counterculture, or medical studies, medical research, peer-reviewed work that has been out there and is slowly trickling through on marijuana, the potential medical benefits of marijuana. People could go and find out for themselves that this wasn't sort of a hippie's pipe dream, these stories of people, helping alleviate symptoms of epilepsy and other diseases by using marijuana. So we have that going on, and an availability of new information. And then you had medical marijuana coming in as a sort of half step, a pilot project. It came in first in California in 1996, and then now it's in 23 states and D.C. But really what medical marijuana did was show that if you opened the door to some forms of legalization, the pillars of society would not crumble, that crime wouldn't spike, addiction rates wouldn't spike, life would go on as it had before. And really it did. Even in states like Colorado, California, and Washington, which had the most wide open medical systems, really the problems were more had to do with signage on medical marijuana dispensaries that was gaudy and a little obnoxious, rather than any real problems on the ground. So by the time it came to actually voting for full recreational marijuana, a lot of people in these states had had years of experience with medical marijuana in their neighborhoods or in their cities, and had seen that it really had not become a problem. Now, and then the third thing that came in, and this is really a late thing that's come in, is our growing awareness of the problem of over-incarceration in America and how the war on drugs and marijuana arrests really has fit into that.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Bruce Barkant, who is the author of the book Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America. Wondering what you think. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234 today, 800-642-1234. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there, or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. The phone number, though, a little different. It's a different number than the one you're used to calling for the Kathleen Dunn Show, 800-642-1234. What questions would you have for Bruce Barkant about legalizing marijuana? Where do you stand on this issue? Do you think it should remain a Class 1 drug at the federal level? Do you think we need to have a repeal of those types of laws at the federal level. Can states do this themselves? What about the conflicts between state and federal law? We'll be discussing all of that the rest of this hour. 800-642-1234. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back and have more of our conversation with Bruce Barcott in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show today. And this hour, the conversation is about legalizing marijuana. We're talking about the book Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America, with the author Bruce Barcott, award-winning author who writes about science, the environment, and the outdoor world. We're about to get deluged with phone calls here because I know a lot of people are going to want to talk about this, and a couple of things I'd like to get to first. We had success in 2012 in Colorado and Washington State in not just decriminalizing marijuana, but making it legal to grow and sell. And that's an important distinction, the difference between legalized marijuana and decriminalized marijuana. Quickly explain those two things, and then I want to get to what has happened in those two states since since they changed the laws there.
Decriminalizing really is a really small half step. Decriminalizing indicates that you sort of dial back the penalties for using marijuana, or you allow a small personal use, but you don't set up any system allowing for for growing marijuana or processing or selling it at the retail level. Okay. What Colorado and Washington did was legalize and regulate marijuana. And that was an important distinction, I think, and it's one of the reasons that both measures passed. You know, you use the word legalization, and it sort of has this smell of throwing open the gates, like anything goes. But when you have regulation, we are creating a regulated system to handle marijuana just like alcohol in Washington State and similarly in Colorado. And so we have a whole framework for growers and sellers to apply for licenses through the state. People are vetted by state regulators in terms of the owners of those businesses. If you're not in the system, if you're not licensed, you can't grow, you can't sell, and it's illegal in that sense. Mm-hmm. But so far, both systems have worked fairly well. Colorado's system is sort of more robust than Washington's. I like to say that Colorado embraced marijuana, where Washington State has allowed it. But I think I know they're doing well. I'm living here in Washington State. I can see the results. And I think other states are going to come online soon. I think California is going to vote on it along with the presidential election next year. Ohio is an interesting one. They have something coming on the ballot in November, but I don't know if it'll pass because it's a strange sort of monopoly setup. So that one actually could be the first new one not to pass. We'll have to see.
Okay. Well, so it's safe to say Colorado has not been overrun by stoners.
Right. I mean, the first couple of months, it was an interesting situation. I mean, I was there January 1st, 2014 in Denver to see the opening of the stores, and it was a sort of rush from around the country. People had gone on road trips. It was, a holiday break for a lot of college students. So there were people from all over the country coming up there.
So there really is such a thing as marijuana tourism.
Oh, yeah, especially in Colorado, not so much in Washington, but, I know a number of people who own shops in Denver, and a significant portion of their business comes in on tour buses, not just from around the country, but from all around the world. People are really curious to see how it works.
So one of the you talked about regulating the production and the distribution and the use of marijuana, and part of that regulation is taxes. Mm-hmm. And Colorado seems to be ahead of Washington State when it comes to how they've developed their marijuana industry. And I want to talk about the differences in those two. You pointed out Colorado embraced marijuana, Washington State allowed it, and I want to talk about how that's played out. But has this been the tax bonanza that some people were predicting for Colorado?
No, I mean, it's never going to be a bonanza. I mean, the market is not insignificant, but it's not enormous. It's not solving any budgetary issues in either of these states. And, you know, I'd say one of the worst reasons for legalizing marijuana is to gain tax revenue. I think that there actually are quite a bit more savings realized in that are sort of invisible that come on the law enforcement end of things and the justice end of things, where we aren't, you know, in Washington State here, we're no longer arresting 12,000 people every year. You know, we're not wasting law enforcement resources carrying out those arrests and sending those people through the court system. So there's a lot of resources sort of to be conserved by these laws. There are some, you know, taxes and some revenue realized, but it's not solving any real problems in terms of budget holes in either state.
Okay, just a curiosity question for the talk show host: what's the difference between high and stoned?
high indicates that you're sort of up and energetic and lively and laughing and. Stoned is much more when you're experiencing what they call couch lock, where you're in a nice easy chair or a couch and you see no reason to leave it whatsoever. That's where stoned comes in.
Okay. I can get that watching reruns of Numbers. let's take some phone calls. Let's go to Duncan in Appleton first. Duncan, hello.
Yes. Hello, everybody. Time flies. Maybe 25 years ago, I read an article in the L.A. Times, a newspaper. That was before the internet, and it was an article about concerts and the emergency medics that look after the concerts and to take care of anything, and for the different music. If it was a Rastafarian concert, mostly pot smoking, there was few emergencies. If it was country music, there'd be fights and bodily damage. If it was rock and roll, it was overdoses they'd take care of. If it was mash pits, there was broken bones. That's all I have to say.
Well, it's an interesting point, Duncan. I got to say, the one of my own little, you know, anecdotal experiments I carried out in the book was I went to the Cannabis Cup in Denver a couple of years ago, and this is sort of a state fair of marijuana. And at the time, this was 2014. A lot of producers were giving away free samples of their pot, so people were lining up to smoke it, to vape it, to imbibe in many ways. And I was there at, you know, 4:20 in the afternoon on the proverbial date of 4:20 when everybody was smoking up ceremonially, and a photographer was with me and I was covering the scene. And so the photographer and I didn't imbibe because I needed to continue working all that day and that night. And it was amazing to see. I was, you know, touring the fairgrounds, and this were like 30,000 people there, mostly young men. And I'm telling you, I did not see one fight. I didn't see any verbal altercation. You know, the people who had a little too much were essentially had found a little spot off in the corner and were curled up in the shade, napping it off and this sort of thing. So it made me think about, you know, well, what if this was sort of an Oktoberfest? Would the scene be the same? And I don't think it is. You know, it's not a scientific study, but it does tend to have that a much more calming effect.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also join the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Lots of people want to talk about this. We had a... I would like you to describe the business of pot in Colorado, since they seem to have the most developed, pot infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work there? Start with the growers and work your way to the retail end.
Sure. You know, Colorado started out with a system where they wanted what they referred to as vertical integration. They wanted the sellers to grow most of the pot as well, just to sort of keep it all clean in terms of its regulation and tracking it. Both Washington and Colorado have a sort of software system where you have to track every plant from seed to sale. So most of the retailers were growing their own pot at the same time, and some retailers sort of turned this into a feature where they'll have a little grow room right there in the store with a big window where customers can come in and see it being grown. And for a lot of customers, it's the first time they've ever seen pot being grown anywhere. But now Colorado's allowing more horizontal integration where you can be just a focus on growing and you don't have to sell. Whereas Washington handled it completely the opposite way. They wanted growers and sellers to have a clean break between them. So you can either be a grower in Washington State or you can sell it, but you can't do both. And all of them are making a go of it. A few people are getting rich, but you know, it's still possible to lose money selling marijuana. It's a very competitive market in both states.
Hmm. Well, you know, actually, Wisconsin has something similar for beer, and somebody will correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think Wisconsin law is if you make the beer, somebody else has to sell it for you.
Mm,
so maybe that's the model they're using, and I could be wrong about that. I'm often wrong, but never uncertain. let's take another call. This time we'll go to Cross Plains and hear from Peter. Peter, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. To bring this up to date, there are many people who are going to be voting on this, as you point out, and a lot of people are still opposed to it, and I think it's extremely important that they understand the history, as you and the author have touched on, that and part of that history is that, as you've said, we've been completely misled about the dangers of this plant, and I'd like to point out that I know from my own reading that it's been used for thousands of years around the world. The scientific name is cannabis, and Anslinger didn't want that name used. He wanted marijuana used so he could better play his racist card, because it was directed towards the Mexican immigrants that were coming through. And it was a commonly prescribed plant, cannabis was, and I think people should realize they've been hoodwinked all these years. Thanks.
Okay, Peter, thank you. Bruce Barka?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. It's interesting. You know, one of the things I did for while researching Weed the People was I wanted to find out, look, if Colorado and Washington are the leading edge of marijuana reform, what's the trailing edge? You know, where are laws the worst in the United States? And really it has been and continues to be Louisiana. Louisiana laws are just insane when it comes to marijuana. I mean, people are sitting in state prison doing 10, 12, 15 years for possession of essentially 2 grams, which is, you know, what I purchased 2 weeks ago down in Uncle Ike's in Seattle. But I wanted to go down there and find out how this was happening, and I would talk to people and talk with them about these laws and how they're still in effect. And I said, well, how does this continue? Why aren't these laws repealed? And they came back mostly with the same answer, which is that, look, the people in power who are in the legislature, they aren't affected by these laws. If you're white and you have some means, you can get out of a marijuana arrest, and you're not likely to get arrested in the first place. But if you are a black person, if you're a person of color in Louisiana and you don't have many means, if you get arrested for marijuana, you're going to get the book thrown at you. But those folks don't have a lot of champions in the state legislature. So that sort of dynamic really continues. Mm-hmm. That was how Anslinger really kind of got those laws passed in the first place, was the people who were in power really didn't care one way or the other about marijuana. They had really no knowledge of it. It didn't touch them.
Okay. Peter, thank you so much for the call. We had a caller earlier who couldn't stay on the line but had a question about research, and that is, has there been extensive research done, for example, on heroin like there has been on marijuana, which is one of the research on this is kind of showcased in your book?
Yeah, it's actually, you know, it's still easier to research heroin than it is to do research on marijuana. The federal government rules around marijuana research are incredibly maddening for the, you know, legitimate scientists who are trying to do this research. So a lot of the research we have comes from overseas. It comes from Israel, it comes from Canada, from the UK, from Spain. There's starting to be more and more research coming out of the U.S., but it's still incredibly difficult to do that research and simply to obtain the marijuana because of federal laws. But the one real breakthrough that I think we've seen in the last 20, 30 years or so is this essentially an understanding that there is this thing called the cannabinoid system in the human body. It's sort of not unlike the endorphin system. It controls a lot of cellular activity in the brain, and marijuana is essentially a plant-derived cannabinoid that mimics the body's own cannabinoids, and that's why it has this effect on us. Hmm. And that's why we think that it has these effects on epilepsy and on potentially on Alzheimer's and a number of other diseases.
Here's an email question from Jane. Jane writes, "We should not be encouraging drug usage. It's not a positive thing. If we are going to discourage cigarette smoking, why would we encourage people to inhale pot smoke into their lungs and alter their brain? Why this strange need to alter your mind with drugs?"
Well, a couple things there. Number one, we don't send people who are caught smoking cigarettes away for 10 and 15 years in prison. That's something we've chosen not to do, and it doesn't work, it wouldn't work. I think that, you know, in a perfect world, we wouldn't have the need to imbibe in mind-altering substances like alcohol and like marijuana. But I think that, you know, frankly, we're human. And I think, you know, you look into any era in history, and human beings have found a need to, you know, make alcohol, have a drink, have some sort of substance to help them relax and take a little bit of, you know, an hour vacation away from the cares of the world. And there are substances like, I think, alcohol, and now I think marijuana is in that category, where we have figured out or are figuring out ways to handle it responsibly, to not let it ruin our lives, and also not go overboard in its regulation. So I think, you know, it's here. We're trying to deal with it in an adult and a logical manner now, and we haven't in the past.
All right, we need to get to a break. We have full phone lines. We've got Facebook comments coming in. I have about four more pages of questions. We should talk to the producers of Central Time and see if they'll let us have their 3 o'clock hour. I think we could easily do another hour and 20 minutes on this. I'm just kidding, so don't anybody in Vilas Hall panic. Talking with Bruce Barcott about the book, Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America. A lot of people want to talk about it. We'll give as many people a chance as we can. When we come back, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the bumps in the road in Colorado. A couple of things happened there. And then the demographics of the pot industry, because that's another fascinating area that needs some discussion. 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or put a comment on Facebook. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about the legalization of marijuana this hour on the Ideas Network with Bruce Barcott, author of Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America. A Facebook comment, and then we'll go to the phones. Eric writes on Facebook, "I think it's possible nationwide after 10 more states to legalize it for recreational purposes, but only after the massive tax influxes like Colorado's are shown and industrial hemp becomes a viable industry in this country. And yes, I think it's inevitable, but probably not for at least 15 to 20 years." Bruce Barcott?
Hemp is a really interesting issue. That is a sort of issue coming over the horizon. Some of the first American-grown hemp crops are coming in right now in Kentucky, and they are coming in because Mitch McConnell, Republican leader, slipped a measure into the last farm bill allowing Kentucky farmers in his own state to start growing hemp and start finding a market for it. Hemp is essentially, it's cannabis, but with negligible amounts of THC. You can't smoke it and get high. So I think hemp is a really interesting issue that people are going to see more and more of down the road.
There, let's talk about bumps in the road. Speaking of roads, edibles, something of a problem in Colorado. The cases of Levy Thamba and Christine Kirk. What was the response of the marijuana industry to these deaths?
Just briefly, Levy Thamba was a college student, underage. I think he was 19 at the time. He and some friends road trip down to Colorado from Wyoming. Bought some edibles, ate too many, and Levy Thamba had essentially a bad trip, and he fell off the railing of a hotel room and died.
He ate a cookie, right?
And this was essentially the way in which Colorado went out early and learned the hard way. You know, some of the problems, and edibles are and continue to be a challenging issue. State law in both states says that the maximum amount of marijuana or THC in an edible is 100 milligrams. Well, nobody knows what 100 milligrams is. We all kind of have an idea of what a can of beer will do to you. But early on, a lot of these cookies were packed with 60 or 100 milligrams of THC, and they would go out and say, well, it's a six-serving cookie. Well, nobody sees a cookie and thinks, oh, six servings.
Yeah, right? I'm going to divide that cookie into six pieces.
So people ate
right.
cookie, and they didn't have a lot of experience with marijuana, because that's how newcomers tend to imbibe, is through edibles. And so they'd have really bad experiences. They'd kind of freak out and get paranoid. So what Colorado did, and Washington as well, was essentially said, hey, listen, we have to do something about this immediately. They called in a committee of stakeholders and came up with new, tighter rules having to do with the amount allowed in each item in a package, having to do with packaging, having to do with warnings on packaging. They started an education campaign with billboards up around Denver saying, you know, start low, go slow, start low, meaning low THC levels. And I think the word has generally gotten out on edibles to really take it easy. And if you're going to try one of these things, try one at a low, like 10 milligram level. I think I tend to put it to people like, look, 10 milligrams in an edible is like a glass of wine. Try one, see how it works out. Wait an hour or two, and go from there. But don't just grab and eat a brownie or a cookie without knowing what's in it.
Mm-hmm. And then quickly, what about the demographics of the pot industry? I mean, for years, the people going to jail for marijuana use and distribution have mostly been minorities. Are they the ones now who are reaping the benefits of legalized pot, or who is?
No, sadly, no. The pot industry is largely white. It is largely male, although that is changing quickly. There are a lot of women growers and shop owners who are getting into the business very quickly. I think Newsweek just had a cover story on women in the marijuana industry. It is still too overwhelmingly white, and a lot of that has to do with the institutional racism that keeps people of color out of any other business, which is essentially lack of access to capital. It costs money to get into this business. Opening up a retail shop can, you know, run you upwards of $70,000 to $100,000 when you start with the lease and you buy all the equipment and the safety mechanisms you have to have in place. So it's that's a large part of it.
Okay. Here's a Facebook comment from Marcus, who writes, social media as well as studies that have come about within the last 15 years is helping to tear down the prohibition of this plant. People still use the debunked gateway theory as a reason for maintaining arresting people for using the plant. Long time coming. The most harmful thing about the marijuana plant is not the plant itself, but our laws surrounding it.
Yeah, the gateway theory has really been debunked, you know, in scientific papers for years now. The gateway that marijuana provided was because of its illegality. The same person who sold you marijuana, if you bought it, was selling other drugs and was likely to try to foist those on you as well. Whereas, you know, in a marijuana shop here in Seattle, it's marijuana. That's what you go in for. That's what you buy, and it's not cheap. You know, the price sort of goes up and down depending on supply here in Washington. But it's a spendy product.
Let's take another call. This time it'll be Jacob in Milwaukee next. Let's see if we can get Jacob on. Jacob, hello. Go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. So I wanted to rewind a little bit, and I wanted to ask about, basically compare and contrast. You said that Nixon had a talk with, I can't remember his name, about the...
Art Linkletter.
Sure.
Art Linkletter, yeah, thank you. About the comparison between alcohol and cannabis, and basically that alcohol really surpassed cannabis as a harmful substance to take in. And then rewinding even further, the Rockefeller oil industry, when they battled against Henry Ford, when Henry Ford wanted to use alcohol in the production of his cars so that he could fuel his cars with alcohol, well, there are speculations that that was one of the main reasons for the prohibition of alcohol. Now, when you look at cannabis as a manufactured good, and you can manufacture a lot of different things from rope to walls to carpeting to most things, how do corporate companies look at this, and how do they see this as a threat that they could end up kind of putting the petroleum business or hindering the petroleum business, or is it something other than that?
So is that a threat to big oil, Bruce Barca?
Yeah, I don't see a big challenge to big oil. You know, there's always in cannabis history circles, there's always a question as to whether the company DuPont had a hand in essentially taking hemp out of the market, because DuPont had nylon and other products coming on the market. I go back and forth. That's sort of a vague theory. But hemp right now is really, it's a craft product. It's a craft industry. It's the kind of thing that, you know, people who are growing it are hoping to sell, you know, in Whole Foods. They're hoping to sell in small markets around the country. It's not a big oil kind of product.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Mike, who is calling us from Madison. Mike, hello.
Yeah, hi. This is Corey, so one of your other Facebook messages you read, in which lady asked about why you would want to encourage the use of marijuana. It seems to me that we openly encourage the use of nasty, toxic pharmaceuticals. To tie in into an earlier NPR story earlier today, talking about ADD and ADHD and how we have so many of our kids chalked up on toxic drugs which are destroying their bodies and their minds. And that seems to be perfectly okay. It seems to be okay that we take our elderly and just fill them full of toxic, toxic pharmaceuticals, and that seems to be okay. So I wonder why this marijuana issue has... I think this part of the reason we've got to this point is my generation, who grew up as a kid from a hippie, who didn't smoke pot but hung out in hippie culture, and I grew up as a hippie and enjoyed marijuana for 25-plus years. I think we finally realized that the pharmaceutical companies have completely lied to us. Our own government has sold us out and allowed these pharmaceutical companies to sell us toxic, toxic chemicals as remedies, as snake oil, and that marijuana is as simple and organic as it is. There has not been one related death until recently, until we decided to start manipulating marijuana like we have cocaine, and turn it into a toxic substance. As a plant, it's wonderfully simple, wonderfully safe, and is better for you than 99% of the pharmaceuticals on the market.
Okay, Mike, we got it. Thank you. Yeah. Bruce Barcott.
Good comment, Mike. Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things that's going on with medical marijuana is that doctors are dealing with this in states, especially like Colorado, where they have patients, or, you know, if they're kids, they have parents of patients coming in and saying, look, conventional drugs aren't working for us. We'd like to try medical marijuana. And the doctors would like to go along with that and help them out, but you know, legally, they're putting their DEA license to prescribe at risk. And then they come down to the question of dosage, where every strain of marijuana is different. Every leaf is different. You don't have the sort of quality control that exists in other pharmaceuticals. So they're a little hesitant to try to work with this. There's a company over in England called GW Pharma, and they're actually doing a lot of work essentially bringing cannabinoids like THC and CBD into the mainstream pharmaceutical industry. There's a lot of controversy about this. You know, there's a lot of people in cannabis circles who are all opposed to that. But there are also folks who are, who I know, who are parents of kids with, you know, chronic epilepsy who are waiting for these drugs to come online and are really hopeful that they'll make a difference.
Mike, thanks for your call. Let's go to Jarrett next in Green Bay. Jarrett, hello.
Hi, how you doing today?
Great.
Good.
Good shape. I'm in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and, you know, in Wisconsin we have certain municipalities that just give fines. And here in Brown County, it's the same thing. There are ordinances that are all over Wisconsin, but if you get in trouble, the police overlook these ordinances, and they just want your money. It's even in the papers around here that these municipalities are all run by the police departments, and they just want your money, whether it be a $200 fine, a $1,000 fine. It's all about money. And then when they start talking about it, it all goes back to this whole debunk, like you spoke of earlier, this gateway. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to the conservative attitude that people just don't want to open up their mind to a new form of therapy.
Okay. Jarrett, we're running out of time, so we got to let you go. But basically the point here, marijuana is going to stay illegal because some people make money off of that.
Well, I mean, marijuana is sort of opens the door. Marijuana laws open the door to civil asset forfeiture, and civil asset forfeiture is a whole, that's another hour for you.
Yeah.
You know. So
we could be here all day.
Yeah.
Jared, thanks for the call. Is there a difference between, in terms of the actual composition between what's sold as medical marijuana and marijuana sold for recreational purposes?
No, there's not. And in fact, in Washington State now, the marijuana sold for recreational purposes is regulated in terms of its quality and its sale, whereas medical marijuana hasn't been. So medical marijuana is finally now coming under the regulated system here in Washington State.
Okay.
We're getting that law cleaned up. But no, there's no difference in terms of,
okay,
of the product.
And we're running out of time, and I wanted to make sure we got this one in. We had an email question from, a comment on Facebook, and it was someplace I wanted to go to anyway. Is there data on impaired driving related to marijuana use in either Colorado or Washington State?
This is really interesting. I mean, they're starting to really try to track it. I know I've been keeping an eye on it here in Washington State, and the numbers in terms of the Washington State Patrol, what they're seeing with impaired driving have gone up. But it's one of those things where we're not sure whether they're going up because the State Patrol is now really keeping a hard eye on it and looking for it specifically, or whether people are actually, you know, using more and going out. It's often also combined with alcohol. It's a weird sort of interaction that happens when alcohol gets together with marijuana.
So,
I basically don't take marijuana and drive. That's essentially my
rule.
You
shouldn't drive impaired, whether it's marijuana or a Benadryl or, you know, anything else. What can Alaska and Oregon, for example, learn from Washington State and Colorado as they move into their legalization phase?
I think one of the main things is to, as you're setting up these regulatory schemes, make them flexible. Make it easy for, you know, the Liquor Control Board in Washington State to go in and tweak the laws here and there, because these are the beta version of these laws. They're not perfect coming out of the gate, and they do need to be changed and perfected as we learn from, you know, small mistakes going along the way. So flexibility is key. Another thing is just to allow these businesses to actually stay in business and make a little money. The taxing can't be so draconian that you essentially put them out of business before they even start.
Okay, well, we really just barely scratched the surface on this conversation, but we're out of time. Bruce Marcotte, thanks for being here today.
You bet. It's been a pleasure.
The name of the book is Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America, published by Time Books. KP Whaley produced this program. We had on-air production help from Cheyenne Lentz, and also Dave Potratz helped us out with some technical assistance today. Thanks to both of them. Kathleen is back tomorrow, so tune in for her at 1 o'clock as usual. It's been my pleasure to sit in for her today. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.